gender binaries apply to God. I don't think God can be contained in he or she. But English only has he or she. So when I preach, I switch gender pronouns to keep it as even as I possibly can. And the other thing that you might not know about me, if you've never seen me preach before, is that I think that laughter is holy and healing, and it bonds us together. So I'd like to start with something funny today. I heard about this older lady who went shopping. And she came out of the store, and she realized that she'd locked her keys in her car. And so she was fiddling with the knob, and she was looking for other ways to get in the car, and she went inside, and she got a coat hanger, and she bent it, and she was poking away at it and everything. She just couldn't get it open. Right then, this huge guy in a motorcycle pulls up. He's got a leather jacket, he's 6'4", shaved head, tattoos everywhere. And he takes the coat hanger, and he sticks it in. Within 15 seconds, he's got the door open. And the lady says, "Oh, thank you, God, for sending me this nice man to help me." And the man says, "Nice? I'm not nice. I just got out of jail for auto theft." And the lady gives him a huge hug and says, "Oh, thank you, Lord, you sent me a professional." May these words be to God's glory. If you look in the back on the table, you'll find a bunch of fresh scones that I brought to share today. I baked them because I spent all last week in Ireland. Now I know why Pastor Blair went there all the time. And every morning I had a scone and eggs and tomatoes and oatmeal and more scones for breakfast. I tried to recreate them as best I could. I admit they're not exactly like the ones I had overseas. I recommend you take them home and put a lot of butter, jam, or Nutella on them. They're a little dry. But they're not bad. And if there are any left over, I'll bring them home to the birds in my yard. While in Ireland, I went on all the tours across the country I could fit in. And of course, I saw a lot of those stone walls, the long ones that go across the hills and everything. And they don't have any mortar in between. They just kind of hang out. They're a classic Irish sight. There's a lot of postcards of them. And I took lots of pictures of them. I had thought, before visiting Ireland, that the walls were livestock pens or that they were built and maintained by the farmers to delineate their property. I learned something different from the tour guide on the bus, though. It started when he called them, in his almost unintelligible to my American ears Irish brogue, famine walls. They were built, he said, during the Great Famine in Ireland between 1845 and 1852. Now, I knew that there had been a potato famine that turned all of the potatoes black inside. But I've always wondered, how did the death of one crop kill a million people? Did the Irish subsist just on potatoes and Guinness? Well, of course not, I learned from the guide. When the potatoes, which were the primary food staple of the poor, began to die, the Irish tried to lean on the alternate food sources they had available. It was a farming country, after all. They had wheat, barley, livestock, butter, that kind of stuff. But until 1922, Ireland was a British colony, and the land was owned by the crown. The Irish themselves were usually tenant farmers. They paid rent. During the time of the famine, the British continued to export the food grown in Ireland, grain and butter in particular, and it was raised by the Irish. In fact, the export of peas, beans, rabbits, fish, and honey actually increased. Most of it went to Great Britain to feed their soldiers, who were busy trying to subdue the citizens of India. The farmers were forced to grow food for their oppressors while they themselves starved. The Irish, of course, petitioned the British for help, or at least to stop sending all the food away. But the British were not about to give the Irish charity. Oh, no. They wanted the Irish to work for their rations. So the British made the Irish build the walls. Every morning, starving men, women, and children woke up and tended the crops they couldn't eat. Then they hauled rocks out of the ground and off the seashore, up and down hills, to build the fences we see today. The walls, in and of themselves, were pointless. They were not delineating property or keeping livestock in check. They were simply a task for the Irish to complete in exchange for help. At the end of the day, often, the officer in charge would claim that the wall wasn't long enough or good enough and deny the workers the rations they had worked for. The Irish had no weapons or recourse, so they kept working, or they fled the country, or they died. The tour guide told us that the rural Irish do not call this period the Great Potato Famine as they do in the history books. They call it the British Genocide. And those walls, they're still up. A monument to bureaucracy. They remind us of the tendency we all have to hide behind institutionalized power, of our love of often arbitrary rules, even, and perhaps especially, in the face of suffering. You may be dying, but you're not getting something for nothing. Now complete this pointless task so I know you're not taking advantage of my generosity. Often laws, rules, procedures, and authority are put in place to foster stability. In their best iterations, institutionalized power helps us not to worry about basic things. Nobody can charge into my living room on a horse and take my house, for example. In theory, nobody can punch me in the face without my having legal recourse. But sometimes, obedience to the rules is simply an excuse for our own cowardice, a convenient excuse that lets us protect ourselves at the expense of others. The British soldiers who forced the Irish to build walls, they were acting in accordance with the law. They were protecting their own families, too, by keeping their jobs. The soldier who beheaded John, same thing. He was just obeying the law. The soldiers who killed Jesus, same thing. In California, there's a housing law called the Costa Hawkins Act. That's Costa Hawkins. It states, in part, that rent control only applies to housing built after 1995. In San Jose, the cutoff year is 1979. So when people go to city council and say, as many have, we're having a housing crisis, the only people who can keep up with the 5% increases in rent every year that we're experiencing are tech folks. We need rent control. City council can say, we'd love to help you, but there's a law in place. We really can't. Thoughts and prayers. In this way, the landlords and developers who contribute millions to campaign funds get to keep making more money, but of course there's nothing anyone can do because, you know, Costa Hawkins. I have to admit the Amos for today makes me super uncomfortable. It's a text where some guy tells an authority figure that the complacence he supports is going to get everyone killed. So, you know, not a super fun text to read. To get some context on what the Amos is, it's prophetic literature, which in the Bible means that it relates to the reasons for the tragedies which befell the Hebrews from about 597 to 722 BCE. When I was in seminary, I really had to work to remember those dates, so I am very proud that I get to use them in sermons. We've talked about this before, but just as a reminder, the Israelites' relationship with God was bound up with their relationship with the lands that they owned. They believed that initially they were granted this land by God because they obeyed her. But then, after hundreds of years of prosperity, the Israelites began to lose their land and their power. They were deported, they were killed, they were slaved. They fell. And as often happens in the face of tragedy, those faced with it tried to find explanations. Today's passage starts with, "This is what the Lord showed me." Amos then goes on to explain that God has judged the Israelites and found them direly wanting. As a result, says God, brace for impact. The sword is coming. When the high priest of Bethel, Amaziah, hears this, he goes to King Jeroboam and he tells him what Amos said. And Jeroboam, in typical leader style, doesn't actually respond directly. Instead, he has Amaziah, who's a religious authority, who's in his pocket, shut Amos down. Amaziah connects holiness and worldly power. He says to Amos, "Never again prophesy at Bethel, for it is the king's holy place and his royal house. Don't mess with the state," says the holy man. In the U.S., we're big on the separation of church and state. But in many circles, the law and God are one and the same. This has precedent in history, and there are even those who claim that Donald Trump was sent by God to reform the nation. Now, whether you like Trump or not, that's a heck of a thing to say, that God ordained our government. Legal obedience. This is what Amos comes up against when he tries to tell people that disaster is coming, the institution of the state. But also, he's shut down by Amaziah, a representative of the institutionalized, dominant religion. Uh-oh. Amaziah was a priest of Bethel. Now, he was not a priest of Yahweh, but he had the backing of the government. He had the wealth and the influence. Amaziah was the Billy Graham of his time. We've all heard the statistics about church attendance falling. Over a third of Americans now identify as religiously, quote, unspecified, which is the highest number in history. Especially in California, being a Christian is denormalized. How many conversations have you had with people where you tell them you're coming to church on Sunday and they go, really? How many conversations have you had with well-meaning people who look at you kind of piteously and go, oh, I just don't believe that there's a bearded guy in the sky who controls all of our actions? Have you, like me, wanted to say, neither do I? But this is because there's a confusion between the divine and the institutions we've set up around the divine. Obedience to red tape has become what the church is known for, unfortunately. It's a wonderful place of community and growth, but it can also be a place of comfort bound up in procedure. And that's good, and it's a little bad. A few weeks ago, I had my ecclesiastical council here at Campbell. Thank you very much for hosting. A bunch of folks were there, a couple of ordained ministers, lay leaders, congregational folks, representatives from the conference. I answered a bunch of questions about my theology and why I wanted to be ordained. And while folks discussed whether to give me a pass for ordination, I was asked to step outside. As often happens at Campbell, there was a homeless woman just outside those doors. I talked to her. She cried. She was messed up. She was so messed up that I couldn't figure out what she needed other than Kleenex, so Mary Alice and I got her some Kleenex. But soon I had to go back inside. After the meeting was done, we all left, smiling and joking for the most part. One after another, every single person who had been in the sanctuary walked past her. Eventually, someone gave her the only thing they could figure out that she needed, a ride to the laundromat. Who was that person? My husband, the Buddhist. The only non-Christian out of perhaps 25 people that day, myself included. We all, firmly on the side of the dominant religion and sure that we were doing God's work by conferring power on the nice white lady who's gone to school for a million years, walked right past this woman because we didn't know what to do with her. I, with all my power and privilege, got blessed by the institution, and she got ignored by it. I'm not saying this to accuse anyone of anything. I would venture to guess that my feelings of discomfort and fear and a sense of not wanting to be taken advantage of were shared by the folks gathered that day. Perhaps we thought, well, we're working for the church, and the church is helping people like this. We're supporting programs that will help her, and we're enabling dependence if we give her money. Well, maybe so. But the fact remains, I didn't give her a ride. It was my husband. And the truth is that I let that happen because he is large, and I am not. What if, when I was alone in the car with her, she was suddenly not incoherent, but very strong? What if she was armed? Worst of all, what if she took advantage of my goodwill, and I was left with that feeling afterwards in the pit of my stomach that someone has made a sucker out of me? I hate that feeling. What if I gave her something for nothing? What if I fed her without having built a stone wall first? So, my husband drove her to where she said she needed to go. It was his physical strength that I relied on to keep him safe and give me a reason not to be alone with her. I hate this, but no matter how often I box or how much weight I can lift, it's not much yet, I'm working on it, he will always be stronger than me because he simply has more muscle mass. I know this because Friday night I passed him an unopenable bottle of nail polish and he twisted it off with no problem. To put it another way, he has power, or a gift, that I don't. And because of that gift, along with his gifts of generosity and patience, he was able to help somebody. Often, we obey the rules because we don't feel powerful. I didn't help that woman because I didn't feel strong enough to do so. So I held to the safety of what I knew. The laws serve as a framework of behavior when we feel too alone to figure out what to do when faced with uncertainty. But Romans 12:6 says, we have different gifts that are consistent with God's grace that have been given to us. If your gift is prophecy, you should prophesy in proportion to your faith. If your gift is service, devote yourself to serving. If your gift is teaching, devote yourself to teaching. If your gift is encouragement, I love that gift, devote yourself to encouraging. In fact, Scripture is full of references to the gifts that were given by God. Whether we know it or not, we all have gifts. We all have some kind of power given to us by the Creator. Now, it may not be physical. If, like me, you're a woman, chances are, you know that you will probably not overpower a man on force alone. But power is often hidden. What are you good at? What's your power? Can you write? Can you do AV? Can you speak in public? Or are you sensitive? Can you listen? Can you argue with scary people? Or do you understand the law? Many people in the room today have a caring superpower. They love people who need a lot from them. My next door neighbors are emergency foster parents, and for the past 2 weeks, they've been caring for a 4-year-old boy who was removed from his family. My neighbors are my age. They have no children of their own. But every night, for the past 2 weeks, we hear the husband playing loud, terrible baseball with this kid in the backyard. They're pouring love into this kid. And in a few weeks, when his extended family takes custody of him, they'll never see him again. And the next time DFAX calls, they'll pick up the phone and they'll take in another one. Compassion is their strength. Their home is their gift, and they're sharing it. Some people today have the gift of music, and they give of it abundantly. Some have a facility for facilities. Some can make meetings stay focused, which in my opinion is a real superpower. Sometimes we don't even know what our gifts are until we're forced to use them. Last time I was here, I mentioned a protest I was attending against the policies of immigration at the border. The night before the protest, I'd been at a planning meeting. It was late, most people had gone home, and I don't know why I was still there, other than I'm kind of an overfunctioner. But right before we ended, the organizer said, it was like 9:30, and she goes, "Oh no, we forgot to designate a police liaison." This event was led by people of color, and we all know what tends to happen when people of color encounter the police. So, the mostly white folks organization that I was a part of had agreed to supply someone to interface with law enforcement. We had to make friends with them, essentially, so nobody got hurt. Arrested? Fine. Some of us were prepared to be arrested. But it was our job to use our privilege and power, however ambiguous and uncomfortable, to protect the people of color. I looked around the table, and everyone looked exhausted. Most of us were filling at least 2 roles already. "I don't want to do another thing," I thought. "This is like my 3rd protest ever, and I'm scared of the cops." But no one spoke up, so I found myself volunteering. And sure enough, the police showed up 1/2 hour after we'd camped out at the U.S. Attorney's office in downtown San Jose. The building manager, a white woman, had called them. She was furious at us. And I don't know how, but she got to the squad cars before I did. So I approached the cops, a clump of 4 of them at first, with my hands visible, smiling, a long way off from the chanting, shouting group of protesters. And they were shouting. Mary Alice was there. She can shout. It's awesome. And I had no idea what to say other than, "Hi, I'm Lauren." They approached me slowly with that sort of calculated gait that cops have, you know, where they're trying to look relaxed, but you know they're sizing you up. One of them said, "Who are you and what are you doing here?" And so I told them. "So we're trying to separate more kids from their families today by getting arrested, is that the plan?" spat the building manager. "No, ma'am," I said. "Those of us on the front lines do not have children." The youngest officer turned to her before she could speak again and said, "We're not doing this back and forth thing." She never spoke to me again. I stood with the cops for perhaps 1 hour. When the building manager was out of earshot, one of them asked me, "What does this have to do with us? This is a national problem. We're local cops." And I said, "It doesn't really have anything to do with you. She just didn't know what else to do, who to call." In the end, law enforcement, which eventually included the sergeant and the lieutenant, who really did not want to be there, never got closer than 1/2 block. The protest was considered a success because if the building manager's outrage was any indication, we had definitely gotten the U.S. attorney's attention. My talent for placating law enforcement has to do with my conditioning around race and my gender. I know how to be submissive and sweet when I need to be, and my skin color protects me from violence at the hands of the state. It makes me really angry that I've accepted this conditioning, and a big part of me is ashamed that I was so good at what might be called manipulation. But on the other hand, I knew exactly what to do and what to say to practically make friends with the cops, perhaps preventing them from escalating the situation simply because they saw a friendly face and they had someone to ask questions. I was able to help other people make a statement against U.S. immigration policy. And it's not like it was all up to me. You know, it was not all me coming in and saving everybody. But judging how some people tried to deal with the police, one white guy yelled obscenities and another hollered, "Bring it on!" Not considering that when cops get spooked, it's not white people who die. I think I did a good thing. Even the things we're ashamed of, the things we don't like about ourselves, can be used as gifts for good. Those weak points are often caused by trauma, and I know that many in this room are survivors. How do I know? Because if you're on this earth, you've survived some stuff. And at the time, it was painful, I bet. Maybe it still is. Statistically, there are rape survivors in the room. There are people who have lost spouses, children, parents. There are suicide survivors, survivors of domestic violence. I know this not because anyone has told me, but because trauma happens to us all. But I bet that because of what you've been through, you have compassion for people who are enduring something similar. I bet that what you went through changed you, and in some ways it made you stronger or more aware or kinder. Perhaps you're still figuring out how to survive. Perhaps you don't know what your gifts are, and that's okay. You don't need to know your gifts because God knows what your gifts are, and He'll show you those gifts in time. In your weakness, in your vulnerability, you may have untapped power. In an early draft of this sermon, I had a brilliant discourse on the rest of Amos about who exactly is doomed. Hint, it's people who hoard resources. And as a white homeowner in one of the most impossible to live in areas of the country, I have no comment. But at a certain point, it just gets to be too much. All of the institutional guilt. We both are and are not responsible for the institutions with which both oppress and unfairly sometimes empower us. So the good news is we have gifts, all of us. And we all, simply by being on this earth and doing things, are having an impact. You can't not. You are connected to others. Your life sends ripples through those around you. Just by being alive, you're having an impact. What kind of impact is it? We are all gifted, empowered in ways we both do and do not understand. You have already done things people will remember forever, and you may not even know it. You've given someone a ride because you have patience and a car. You have loved someone when they felt utterly unlovable because you know what it is to hate yourself, and you know how much you needed love then. You raised a child nobody else could possibly have raised. You have made a meeting shorter so people could spend time with their spouses. God has equipped you to make a difference, and you're doing it already. The weight of all the power, the laws, the institutional injustice may seem utterly crushing. There are an awful lot of stupid, pointless walls that are built and still being built out there. But God has put you where you need to be. And all you need to know is, where is your power?